Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Thank you, Estelle. Coming up on today's edition of World in Focus, the Brazilian Senate is currently voting on whether to impeach the embattled, suspended President Dilma Rousseff. The vote is expected to succeed and follows a nine-month campaign by her opponents, which will likely see her Conservative Vice President, Michel Temer, officially installed as President. We'll be asking, when next for Brazil?
Going on from reports over the past few weeks highlighting allegations of severe abuse at Australia's offshore detention centres, the opposition Labour Party will tomorrow bid to launch a full-scale inquiry into the treatment of refugees and asylum seekers.
The French government have come under fire for the appointment of Jean-Pierre Chevènement as the head of the newly formed Foundation for Islam in France.
The Bolivian President Evo Morales has suggested that the Organisation of American States, or OAS, is biased towards right-leaning states in the region and that it hasn't stepped in to defend left-wing governments in Latin America. We'll be asking whether he's right.
The Israeli police commissioner has sparked controversy for stating that it's, quote, natural for officers in Israel to be more suspicious of Ethiopians, Palestinians and all migrants in general.
And the ultimate clean getaway. How did thieves get away with $17,000 worth of soap?
All that and more over the next half hour on this Wednesday edition of World in Focus. Just as we go to air, the Brazilian Senate is expected to vote to impeach the country's suspended president, Dilma Rousseff, in the culmination of a nine-month campaign. More than two-thirds of the 81-seat Senate are predicted to convict her of budget irregularities, thus removing her from office.
Dilma Rousseff spent her formative years with a number of left-wing political groups which fought against the military dictatorship in Brazil from the 1960s through to the 80s. During that time, she was captured, tortured and jailed, and in the years that followed, she went on to found the Democratic Labour Party, before going on to join the Workers' Party at the turn of the new century.
It was there where she worked closely with her mentor, President Lula da Silva, and ultimately became the first female president of Brazil in a narrow runoff election in 2010. Last year, however, Dilma Rousseff and others, including her predecessor, Lula da Silva, were subject to a slew of accusations regarding corruption, specifically concerning the state-owned oil company Petrobras, something for which prosecutors have found no evidence of thus far. But she is also accused of massaging government finances with loans from state banks, a practice which has been used by many administrations in the country.
Depending on your politics, Dilma Rousseff's potential impeachment marks one of two things. Her opponents believe it's a new dawn in a fight against corruption inside Brazil's political establishment, but her supporters believe it's little more than a coup d'etat and the endgame of a conspiracy to oust the Workers' Party in lieu of a democratic election.
Joining me on the line now from London is Anthony Pereira from King's College London's Brazil Institute. Thank you for talking to us, Anthony. Now, up until now, most of the analysis has centred around the allegations against Rousseff and the rights and wrongs of the impeachment procedure. If we could put those things to one side for a moment, though, and look ahead to what happens next. How easy will the formal transfer of power to her former vice president, Michel Temer, be?
I think it'll be more difficult than the only other impeachment, really, that's ever happened in Brazil, which was Collor de Mello in 92, just because, you know, there's a bit more sense here of the arbitrariness and unfairness of it. And also, this is a party, the Workers' Party, that has some capacity to mobilize some segments of the population. So in constitutional terms, it's not complicated. It's quite smooth. And I think Michel Temer will have the support of, as we've seen from the vote, of course, in the Senate, he'll have the support of the majority in Congress. He'll have the support of business sectors. He will try to emphasize the constitutional continuity and seek allies abroad as well. But I think it's going to be difficult for the government just because of the situation that the country is in, the economic and political situation. So it will be challenging.
And what about the political shift then that's about to take place, or arguably has been taking place already, whereby Brazil looks set to veer down a much more conservative path, particularly regarding Temer's plans to curb public spending?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point that you're making there. You know, the relationship of this impeachment to corruption is very ambiguous because although, you know, all this corruption has been going on and has started to be investigated since March of 2014, especially the Petrobras case, Many of the people in this new Temer government appear to be, or their allegations that they were involved in this. So this is ambiguous in relationship to corruption. It's not ambiguous, as you say, in relation to economic policy. This is clearly a government that wants to be more liberal in economic terms, wants to privatize state assets, wants to liberalize the regime for the pre-salt oil, wants to, in many ways, it's a sort of conservative restoration. It's wants to, I think, limit spending on health and education and limit social spending to some extent. And so it is the coming to power of a latent criticism that's been there throughout the 13 years of PT rule, that the solution for economic problems in Brazil are liberal ones. And because of that, I think it'll have the support of a lot of the business community and market actors when it starts, at least when it begins in its formal sense after the impeachment.
And one of the main reasons, of course, as you pointed out there, behind the moves to impeach Dilma Rousseff concerned accusations of corruption, particularly involving the state-owned oil company Petrobras. Strangely, of course, that scandal reached far beyond Dilma Rousseff, and many of those implicated still actually remain quite high up in the Brazilian government. So, I mean, was Dilma Rousseff then the first in a great corruption purge, or was she simply a scapegoat for a scandal which ran much deeper?
Well, that's a great question. I think even though some of the people involved in this impeachment process might have liked to halt the anti-corruption investigations, I think they're autonomous enough that they won't be able to do that. So I think it's really hard to come down on one side or the other of that dichotomy that you're creating. But it's what's clear from the speech, because I was watching some of the speeches last night, and a lot of the senators who were speaking, who wanted to vote in favor, seemed to be saying that they were judging Dilma not simply on this budgetary maneuvers, but on the sort of total ensemble of her presidency, including the difficulties in governing, creating a coalition in Congress, the fiscal deficit, the economic and political problems. And I think that one of the things that we can see is that the PT appears to have gotten involved in the same patterns of corruption that the politicians of all stripes in Brazil have been engaged in, kickback schemes to finance campaigns and so on. But it did so in a very disciplined way for project of power, and the other parties don't see, the politicians from other parties don't seem to forgive the PT for that. I mean, that's a crucial difference, I think, in that it was a disciplined party that had a long-term view of what it could do in power, and really there is no other party that has that kind of structure and discipline. So that came out in these speeches last night, and I think we will see further investigations into corruption. There will be other scalps. What I'm not sure about is whether there'll be the kind of political reforms that would diminish the incentives for politicians to engage in these kinds of corruption.
Anthony Pereira, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks very much.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Still to come on the programme, Australia's opposition Labour Party will tomorrow bid to launch a full-scale inquiry into the treatment of refugees and asylum seekers at Australia's offshore detention centres.
The French government has come under fire for the appointment of Jean-Pierre Chevènement as the head of the newly formed Foundation for Islam in France.
Bolivian President Evo Morales has suggested that the Organization of American States is biased towards right-leaning states in the region and that it hasn't stepped in to defend left-wing governments in Latin America. We'll be asking whether he's right.
The Israeli police commissioner has sparked controversy for stating that it is, quote, natural for officers in Israel to be more suspicious of Ethiopians, Palestinians and all migrants in general.
And is it the ultimate clean getaway? How did thieves get away with $17,000 worth of soap?
Over the past several weeks, we've been covering the continued allegations of abuse in the Australian detention centres on the Pacific island of Nauru and on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island. Last week saw several protests across Australia, all with one key message.
We know that there's only one solution. close the camps, bring them here and let them stay.
Currently, a peaceful protest on Nauru is into its 165th consecutive day, with many of those held there standing beneath a large banner with flags from countries across the globe, which reads, quote, "We are asking the world to take us from hell." It states that those protesting have now spent 1,138 days in detention. The opposition Labour Party will tomorrow put forward a motion in the Australian Parliament to launch a wide-ranging Senate inquiry into the allegations of child abuse and sexual abuse in Nauru, which is expected to gain crossbench support from members of the Green Party.
Journalists are banned from entering Nauru, and any employee or former employee of the detention centre could face a 2-year jail sentence if they discuss their time there. This week, a delegation of politicians from Denmark were refused entry to Nauru during a visit which had been planned for some time. One of the MPs, Joanne Schmidt-Nielsen of the Left of Centre Red Green Alliance, said on Facebook, quote, "It's absolutely unacceptable and anti-democratic and says everything about the situation in Nauru that critics are denied access."
Earlier today, I spoke to Con Karapanayiotidis, a human rights lawyer and founder of Australia's Asylum Seeker Resource Centre. I asked him if, given the international response to the recently leaked files detailing abuse, the inquiry being called for by Labour and protests occurring across the globe, can the Australian government really continue to dismiss the allegations, especially given the legal implications regarding a possible breach of human rights?
Look, it's important to understand, first of all, that the Australian government knows that women are being sexually abused, that children are being sexually abused. They've known this for years now. Like, the centre's been open almost 4 years, and they've had reports of this for over 2 years. Our Prime Minister was briefed fully on this back in March of this year. The Minister for Immigration, the subsequent one, the one previously, knew for more than 2 years. They actually don't care. And I'll go a step further. They actually want such horrific conditions to be maintained because it's part of their policy of deterrence at any cost, of cruelty at any cost, to serve their own political agenda. When you look at the denial, that reminds me a lot of the way in which we were able to get away with decades of institutional child abuse in churches. It gives you a great insight into how was that possible. And you see a very similar narrative: minimise, scapegoat, deny, deny, deny. And you can see very similar dynamics playing out about cast enough doubt, politicise the issue, attack the messenger, and you'll be able to paralyse enough of the populace to not demand action and to demand change.
That indeed was the subject of the Human Rights Watch Amnesty report. They suggested that the Australian government was purposely allowing this to happen to dissuade other people from trying to make the journey by boat to Australia. Though surely at some point the international community and the community within Australia has to question the legalities of this stance. If they are consistently turning a blind eye to huge abuses of human rights, is there not something that can be done to hold the government to account then?
Well, first of all, we very much need to return to a question of values and morals. I ask people this, and that is child abuse acceptable under any circumstances? Because the narrative people argue is that Nauru is a necessary evil. So I posit that question: is child abuse justifiable under any circumstances? And I've yet to meet a human being that says it is. And then I ask them, why would you tolerate Nauru? Is the torture of human beings justifiable under any circumstances where that person has committed no offence? And people will say, well, of course not. Then why would you tolerate what's happening on Manus? So we have got work to be done here around what is happening beyond the illegality of it. Is we really want to be talking about the immorality of it and how depraved it is that we have our policy, the abuse of women and children, and a policy of die somewhere else, and in willful meant returning people at sea to possible torture and death as our standing policy. Now, when faced with what is a humanitarian issue and faced with what is a moral obligation and an obligation of any caring, decent, democratic society to afford protection, we're not having the real debate in this country. Our debate is similar to what's happening in Europe, where we're obsessed with talking about the wrong issues, such as how do we stop people coming? How do we stop smugglers? How do we stop boats? Rather than asking the right questions: how do we save people? How do we help more refugees? How do we facilitate safe passage so that people are not perishing at sea? Now, how are we going to get this change happening? Quite honestly, it's not going to come through the courts, and it's not going to come through arguing the economics, as insane as the billions that we're spending are on this. It's going to come through a shift around the values of a society and the demands of a society that they want something better. And a lot of the work that we are doing right now as an organization that we are doing as we speak right now is that we are focusing on shifting the narrative. And we're working on this across the country, which is the only way we're going to get to a point where there's a tipping point where more Australians, whether it's here or people in any country, is going to be when the populace sees people seeking our safety as human beings deserving of the same equality and dignified treatment. Now, once we reach that point, then these policies will become unsustainable. So we're talking generational change, we're talking education, we're talking about a refocusing of the entire narrative from a narrative that is punitive, a narrative that is focused on deterrence, to a narrative that's talking about values, moral obligations and opportunity if we do the humane and right thing.
Con Karapana Giotidis, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
On Monday, following a meeting between French Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve and Muslim community leaders in Paris, it was announced that the former Interior Minister, Jean-Pierre Chevènement, would be appointed as head of the newly formed Foundation for Islam in France.
The foundation aims to improve relations between the French state and the Muslim community, but many have questioned the appropriateness of Chevènement's appointment and have suggested that a Muslim politician would have been a more appropriate choice.
Joining us on the line is Yassar Alouati from the Collective Against Islamophobia in France. Yassar, thank you for joining us today. What was your initial reaction to Chevènement's selection?
Quote, unbelievable, this government, like the ones before it, will never learn, end quote.
Other members of the board have suggested that he is an acceptable head in the short term, and his political record suggests that he's a man with a strong sense of moral justice. Could he provide an important tie between mainstream politics and issues relating to Islamophobia and national security?
Well, let's go over his political career. He was friend with one of some of the most brutal dictators in the Arab world, like Saddam Hussein, and today, Bashar al-Assad, and before that, Hosni Mubarak, etc. When he was appointed, the first thing he told Muslims was to be discreet. Then he went on and said, well, I know the Muslim world because I traveled there 40 and 50 years ago. He's the same person who legitimized the police brutality against Muslim, you know, youngsters in the 90s when he was Minister of Interior. Add to it that this so-called foundation was not set up from the ground up by speaking directly with the Muslim community, but it came directly from the government itself, which is a clear violation of laïcité, which is constantly used to crack down on individual freedoms of Muslims. And to finish everything, Jean-Pierre Chevènement was not even elected for the position. He was nominated, which means, again, he was put in that place by his friends, white non-Muslim politicians. I think it's more than time we start treating Muslims like fully-fledged adult citizens. This initiative is bound to fail because of the reason I just mentioned.
And so I imagine then you would believe that this discredits the entire foundation and the work that it aims to do.
Definitely. I mean, when you set up a foundation in the ministry without speaking directly with the people it's supposed to represent, when you only appoint hand-picked people who do not have any legitimacy from the masses or the grassroots organization or the mosque or the everyday Muslim, what's going to be its role? Repeat what the government wants to hear? Well, you know, Nicolas Sarkozy did the same thing with the CFCM, and it was a blatant failure. The approach of the so-called French Islam is a neo-colonial approach as long as we refuse to grant autonomy to any organization. And this, you know, foundation will have no autonomy because I just mentioned how it was set up and how it will operate. So if you don't grant autonomy, forget about it. It is bound to fail.
Well, Yassar Alouati, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
The Bolivian president, Evo Morales, has suggested that the Organization of American States, or OAS, is biased towards right-leaning states in the region and that it hasn't stepped in to defend left-wing governments in Latin America. Evo Morales' comments were aimed specifically at the OAS's Secretary General Luis Almagro, the former Uruguayan foreign minister, highlighting his support for right-leaning governments and opposition movements such as in Venezuela.
These comments come on the back of similar criticisms from the Bolivian president last week over the release of a Venezuelan opposition leader, Leopoldo López, who was embroiled in violent protests 2 years ago, which saw 43 dead and 800 wounded. One of Morales' most prominent arguments is that Almagro's moves against the embattled Venezuelan administration run in contrast to his supposed inaction on what Bolivia views as a coup in Brazil, referring to the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, which we covered at the top of the programme.
Joining me on the line now from La Paz is the Bolivian journalist Alfonso Gumucio. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us, Alfonso. The OAS, and specifically its Secretary General Luis Almagro, is biased and doesn't defend leftist governments in the region that are under attack, or so says Evo Morales. Is he right?
Well, you know, my take on this is, first, for the first time, we have someone from the left heading the Organization of American States. Mm. Luis Almagro is someone that comes from the government of Mujica. Come on. I mean, the only leftist government in South America that has came out clean all these years. So he's not a rightist person. He's just a Democrat, okay? Mm-hmm. And I think the things he's signaling and underlining that are happening in Bolivia or are happening in Venezuela and other countries are completely right, and people in my country agree with him, okay? So it's very difficult to disqualify Luis Almagro because he has already a past that speaks for him. What Evo Morales is saying, that there's a kind of conspiracy against leftist governments, I would say, what leftist governments? I mean, there's a discourse, a leftist discourse in governments as Venezuela and governments as Bolivia, but if you go to the facts, I would like someone to show me what are the facts that show that these are leftist governments. Hmm. These are very authoritarian governments that are remaining in power against the constitution over 10 years now here in Bolivia, okay, violating the constitution that they themselves approved in 2009, and we don't see really any real changes, social changes, economic changes. We don't see them. What we see is an increasing of violence. What we see is an increasing of restriction of liberties, of persecution of people that think against. And I'm not speaking as a rightist person. I'm someone that has been in exile 2 times by the military. And many of the people that think like myself have been in exile and have been fighting against the military during many years, something that the people that are right now in the government didn't even notice because they were not active in those times and they don't know what's a dictatorship.
So would you say then that this idea of leftist governments in South America is a simplistic one and that Evo Morales' perspective is a simplistic one?
Absolutely, absolutely, because people were very, I mean, I'm among the few, because I knew a little bit Evo Morales, I'm among the few that wrote as a journalist 10 years ago saying I don't trust Evo Morales as a person, okay? But many of my colleagues that came from political parties from the left were very enthusiastic and said, no, we really need to give him a chance, and we this is a process of change, things will be different from now on, etc., etc. Well, all these friends now are against the government because they have realized that it didn't work. It was a discourse. It still is a discourse that doesn't relate with reality. In reality, things that are happening are very, very serious and really are compromising the future of this country. My recommendation for all people that are listening to this or are interested in Latin America is separate the discourse from the reality. Look at the reality. Look at what is really happening at the reality. Because the rest is discourse, and it's very easy to blame imperialism and to blame anybody else, saying that that's why we are not well appreciated and our image, international image, is decaying, etc. No, let's see what is happening in each of our countries, and then you will see what's the reality.
Alfonso Gumucio, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
The Israeli police commissioner, Roni Al-Sheikh, sparked controversy yesterday when he told a meeting of the Israeli Bar Association in Tel Aviv that it is, quote, natural for officers in Israel to be more suspicious of Ethiopians, Palestinians and all migrants in general. Mr. Al-Sheikh said, quote, all over the world it is proven that migrants are more involved in crime than others. He then added that when an officer met a suspect of Ethiopian descent, he would naturally be more cautious.
The remarks were immediately met with criticism, with members of an umbrella group for Ethiopian immigrants in Israel calling for Al-Sheikh to be fired. The Jerusalem Post reported that audible gasps could be heard from the lawyers present at the conference in response to the comments. Matthew Aiton spoke to Yossi Meckelberg, a lecturer in international relations at Regent's University London and a researcher at Chatham House.
So when people discuss ethnic tensions, even racism, in the context of Israel, they usually invoke the treatment of the Palestinian people, but its record on the treatment of its citizens of African descent, like Ethiopians, is notoriously bad too, isn't it? Can you tell us a little bit about this?
I'm afraid societies are not free of racism. And Israel is not unique in this, but definitely in relations to the Ethiopian, there is a record, a sad record, tragic record of racism towards them. Of course, there are not many black Jews, and they are not in Israel. They start arriving in the 1980s. You know, one of the, I don't know if the ironies of the tragedies of all of it, that Israel put a lot of efforts to bring them, a lot of money, also took risks by using its security forces, airplanes, to bring them to Israel. And when they came to Israel, they faced severe racism. And the recent remark by the Director General of the police in Israel about, you know, it's natural to suspect them more than others because they're new immigrants, is a bit surprising, considering that only last year, you see, all the Ethiopian population in Israel is 120,000. Okay? Only last year, there were 30,000 migrants coming to Israel. So in 1 year, quarter of the entire Ethiopian population that started coming more than 30 years ago. And, you know, they came from France, they come from the Ukraine, they come from Russia, from the United States, and a tiny, tiny, tiny minority still come from Ethiopia. It's a trick. But no one, you know, actually mentioned that, you know, migrants from France or from the United States are a threat to Israeli society. No one mentioned that level of criminality, or as Mr. Al-Sheikh put it, that it's natural for policemen to suspect because evidence shows that migrants are more inclined to engage with criminality, while Israel is a country, since its inception, absorbs migrants.
Yes, as you alluded to there, Jewish citizens of the United States and Europe take the aliyah, that is the Jewish right to move to Israel, on a regular basis, but they don't seem to receive the same treatment as Jewish people of African descent, which leads one to conclude that this is simply racism.
I think there is a strong element of racism, there is no doubt about. And if there is, you know, if the top policeman in Israel has evidence that Ethiopians are more engaged with that, with criminality, the society should ask itself why. And, you know, elements of deprivation, of racism, of bad absorption of them in Israel, so the way the society is treating them. But the way he put it, and the way that we experienced this in the past, also treated by the police, in case of beating up completely innocent Ethiopians, can point out mainly that there is a, in the name of the you know, the McPherson Commission here in the UK, that there is institutional racism.
Okay, Professor Meckelberg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, and finally, the hunt is on in Hawkesbury, Ontario, for the slipperiest kind of thieves you could possibly imagine. Currently on the run after stealing $17,000 worth of hand soap. I shouldn't laugh.
So, Jack, did they get a clean getaway?
Well, at the moment it looks as though they have, but police are on the hunt. They say this won't wash.
Did they actually say that?
No, I just said that. But they could have. They could very well have said that. Either way, it all sounds like something out of a soap opera.
Is that the best pun you could think of?
It's the best pun I could... Yes, it is the best pun I could think of, definitely.
Well, fortunately, with all the soap puns out of the way, that's all we have time for in this edition of World in Focus. We don't need to hear them. Don't forget, you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we hand over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartman Show, so stay tuned for that. Till tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster.
And me, Carolyn Scott. Goodbye.